I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome back to Radio Times. Google things people collect, and you'll come up with an eccentric list of items. Thimbles, Pez dispensers, lunchboxes, dice, buttons, VH copies of the movie Speed, Santa figurines, keychains, manhole covers. I could go on. It seems there is something for everyone to collect, and many people do. What is behind the desire to collect, and when does collecting cross the line and become hoarding? We have three guests who have joined us on Radio Times to talk about all of this. Here with us in our Philadelphia studio is Ronald Bishop. He's a professor of communications at Drexel University, the author of three books, including More, The Vanishing of Scale in an Over-the-Top Nation. Ronald Bishop, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Oh, thanks. Great to be here.
Nice to have you here. Also with us, Randy Frost. He's the Harold and Elsa Cipolla Israel Professor of Psychology at Smith College, a leading expert on hoarding. In fact, I interviewed him and his co-author about a book they wrote just a year or so ago called Stuff, Compulsive Hoarding and the Meaning of Things. Randy Frost, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you, Marty. Nice to be here.
Nice to have you with us. And also with us is Danielle Arnett. She writes the Smart Collector column for Tribune Content Agency. She also covers Chicago and the area for Maine Antique Digest. And Danielle Arnett, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Oh, it's a pleasure.
Well, okay, let's begin with everyone's collections here. What do you collect, Ronald Bishop, or what have you collected?
Well, let's see. I had a long-standing attempt to collect a full set of those little gumball football machine football helmets.
I know exactly what you're
talking about. Yeah, beginning when I was, I guess, about 9 or 10, growing up in New Jersey, and finally, about 3 or 4 years ago, at the ripe old age of almost 50, got the last one.
Really?
So, yeah.
A complete set.
Complete set. They changed logos, teams, but I had to have them all, so I finally have them.
We'll get back to that. How about for you, Randy Frost? Are you a collector?
I don't have many collections. I have one small collection of Tomtons, or they're Swedish trolls that are originally, the legend is they protected the Swedish farm from foxes and wolves and things.
And how many do you have? Do you know?
Oh, I probably have maybe 24.
Okay. And how about for you, Danielle?
Well, I call myself a recovering collector. I was into it very heavily, and I was married to a collector. My husband's now deceased, but he was a heavy collector. And so I know the syndrome. But I am recovering at this point.
And recovering from, I was reading something that you wrote about collecting dolls for a while.
No, I never collected
dolls. Oh, you did?
Dolls.
Okay. So, yeah. So when you were a collector, what were you collecting?
I knew it when I saw it. I'm a very visual person, as are many collectors. And when I wanted it, I had it. Okay. And we'll get into it later as to when you hear that little voice that says, enough is enough.
And we will get into that. Let me go back to the, I guess I'll start with you, Ronald Bishop, which is, you know, why do people collect? As you said, you were a kid. These little football helmets meant something to you as a kid. What are the reasons that people collect?
Well, for me, and I have done a little bit of research on this with other groups of folks, I think it started certainly with a burgeoning love, I guess, for football as a kid and just enjoying playing it and watching it on TV. But I think as I got older, and this is sort of borne out in the research that I've done, it sort of is a way of recapturing that history or that sense of place, I guess, or time.
You know, your childhood, you mean?
Yeah. And I think, you know, especially as life gets a little more complicated, certainly happy, but complicated, lots of things going on, I think lots of folks sort of want to reach back and in some cases, not all,
right,
and to try to just grab a hold of plastic football helmets, or for me, another small collection is stuff related to the Mets, which is my favorite team, as you've seen.
Clearly, are
jacket,
a sports
right?
guy, yes.
And so that just sort of, and there have been a number of writers who've said that that's what folks mm-hmm. try to do, is just grab a hold of what made meaning for them in their past lives and reintroduce it into their current lives.
And Randy Frost, as a psychologist, does that make sense to you?
Absolutely, yeah. When we look at the reasons why people save things, most of the time for collections, it is a sense of what some people call essentialism. That is, that an object has an essence that goes beyond its physical characteristics. So if you think about, for instance, a ticket stub from a favorite concert you went to, there's nothing about that, the physical qualities of that ticket stub, that's all that special. What gives it meaning is the essence that you apply to it, and that essence has to do with its association with an event or a person or a thing.
Could we also call that nostalgia, Andy?
Also nostalgia, yeah. A similar or sentimental saving, that kind of thing.
And Danielle, I think there are other people that collect for aesthetic reasons. I mean, they find something beautiful. For a while, I collected teapots just because, frankly, I like the way teapots look, and there's some pretty funky-looking ones out there. What role do you think aesthetics plays?
Well, I think it's very important, but I think at the very, very bottom of it, it is a need to protect yourself against the slings and arrows of the harsh world out there. And if you choose to do so with miniature football helmets, because it's a finite collection and you can send yourself on a search and you know when the collection is done, and that's a very pleasing thing. Or if it's the teapots that give you pleasure to look at, that is how you define yourself. That's how you protect yourself.
Do you think that's true, Randy?
I think for some people that's true. There's a certain amount of pleasure involved, I think, and people become connected to the world through their collections. That this gives them a sense of community. It gives them a sense of belonging to this world, a sense of personal history, of recapturing one's history and maintaining it. It's like a part of one's self, almost. In fact, many people who write about the concept of ownership talk about the possessions we own as extensions of the self. And in a sense, you can see that with collecting things that are a part of your history.
And something
I am what I collect.
Right.
Exactly.
Aren't we all?
Right.
But I'm going back to you, Ronald, you were saying something like 70% of the population collects something or has collected at some time in their life?
Yeah, thereabouts. And I wanted to go back to something I think Randy mentioned just for a minute. It also becomes, and not to focus too much on the monetary side of it, it becomes almost like a form of social currency. I mean, it enables the collector to sort of do two things. I think the protection idea is right on and sort of arming yourself against the rest of the world. But I think it also gives you a way to, even though the stories might be a little, you know, in the case of 50-year-old man collecting football helmets, silly.
You said it, not me.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, okay. Exactly. To sort of get back into the world, to sort of be the entree into conversations or interaction where without that item or that collection, it might not have happened as easily.
Well, I'm curious, since you've mentioned your football helmets, so where are they? Are they displayed somewhere?
They are in an IKEA. Sorry if that's a mention of a product, but they're in a cabinet in my office that I share with my wife. She works at home. And they sit there in, you know, neatly arranged rows by league and division, I think, which is...
And you get pleasure looking at them or taking them out?
And I think Randy hit it on the head. I think it's just remembering, you know, playing football with my friends, pickup games and watching games and all of those great memories that come out whenever I look at them.
Yeah.
And it's pretty nice.
Randy, does it say something about us, about how we display then our collections or what we do with them?
Well, I think in some contexts it does. And the context it does is really where the breaking point is between someone who has a lot of stuff and someone who has a real problem with hoarding. Because in hoarding disorder, people who have extensive clutter that interferes with their ability to live, that's where we see the breakdown in the display. For people with hoarding problems, we very seldom see them displaying the objects that they have collected. And it's one of the big differences between someone who's a collector and even a heavy collector from someone who has a hoarding problem.
And to you, Danielle, you said your husband was a collector, as were you. Was your house full of your collections on display?
Yeah, I do remember my husband walking out of the garage and saying, well, it's happened. I really don't know what I have anymore. And there's a difference between that and collect and hoarding. And, you know, we can get into that. But I did want to make one point from my perspective of tracking collecting for decades. the generation that has disposable income is the generation that drives the market in collectibles and in collecting. And they tend to collect on a basis of personal history. In other words, you're buying back your past. It's the middle-aged gentleman who buys a cap gun that his mother wouldn't let him have for Christmas one year. That's a whole thing in collecting. I will have it now. I can have it now. And that's a big pleasure of collecting.
And this was the, to use your example, this is the thing that you couldn't have as a kid because your mom wouldn't let you. Now that you're a grown up, you can buy it for yourself.
Correct.
I wonder, too, is it, there's so many ways, perhaps I'll go back to you, Ronald, which is, you know, I'm thinking of eBay. I mean, there's just so many ways now that you can find things, you know, whatever that thing is that you're collecting. Do you think that makes collecting easier or even more enticing?
I think it's a little bit of both, actually. I think that, you know, the zealousness that sort of is, and I was hinting at a minute ago, sort of overtakes certain people when they collect. I think it also can, it can be, make it a lot easier, as you point out, but also heighten the tension, because one of the things that in the research I've done with exploring collecting is that there's this level of intensity. The quest for an item becomes at times very consuming. And so to have more options and more places to go, and this is just a guess, I guess, can only, I think, sort of make that feeling that I need the next one a little bit more intense, that the you have more places to look, basically. And I find that with, you know, when I was finishing up the collection with the helmets, you know, going on to eBay and all of a sudden finding 1,000 other people who had the same hobby collection or interest and wanting to go through every one and what do they have. And it kind of can get almost distracting in a way. So not to sound, you know, hopelessly old-fashioned, but, you know, having only a few places to go might make it more enjoyable.
Do you agree with that, Randy?
I think so. I think, you know, in trying to create a community in this way, you feel a part of something, and the more intimate that something is, the easier it is to connect to the community and feel like you really are a kindred spirit with someone.
Well, let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about collecting in this hour of the show. And all of us have talked a bit about some of the things that we have collected over the years. And we want to hear from you. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. And I'm looking at a bunch of Facebook comments as well. And again, our guests are Ronald Bishop and Randy Frost and Danielle Arnett. So let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation and talk more about what it means to collect things. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about collecting in this hour of Radio Times. We also want to talk a bit about when collecting becomes a problem and even becomes hoarding. And let me reintroduce our guest. With us in our Philadelphia studio is Ronald Bishop. He's a professor of communications at Drexel University, author of a number of books, including More, The Vanishing of Scale in an Over-the-Top Nation. Joining us by telephone, Randy Frost. He's the Harold and Elsa Sipola Israel Professor of Psychology at Smith College, a leading expert on hoarding. In fact, co-authored a book called Stuff, Compulsive Hoarding and the Meaning of Things. And Danielle Arnett, she writes the Smart Collector column for Tribune Content Agency. And it looks like an explosion of phone calls here at 1-888-477-9499. Randy, let me put this to you, and Ronald and I were talking about this during the break, whether for collectors, they're the ones that really enjoy the hunt, and then they're ones that really enjoy the kind of possession, the owning of the thing that you have collected. Does it make sense to sort of see collectors in those categories?
Yeah, I think so. The collection part of it is a different set of behaviors and a different set of motivations almost than the actual ownership piece of it. because in the collecting of it, there's a whole process, and some people have written about the stages or the steps that people go through in acquiring something. It's almost like a courtship phenomena where they identify something, they research it online, they research it however through other means as well, and then finally come to the point of making the decision to acquire the object and so forth. So it's very deliberate and very thoughtful for the most part.
I mean, you become an expert in that thing, right?
Exactly. And that's, I think, another one of the motivations that for all of us as human beings, it gives us a sense of accomplishment to become an expert at something, to know something completely. And that's something that collecting gives us when we do that kind of background.
And, Ronald, when you got all your football helmets, the hunt was over, right?
Yes, and it was kind of on to the next one, as we were saying during the break. I just wanted to go back and mention, too, that the idea that the expertise is helped along by what we were discussing earlier, the fact that there are now so many places and websites and blogs and things that talk about, you know, different items and different collections. So you can become that expert that Randy mentioned pretty, I wouldn't say easily, but there are just more opportunities to be able to sort of show off or display that expertise. But you're right. I mean, there was I sort of looked at the last piece of the puzzle and was, okay, what do I do now? As we were saying, you know, now it's done.
Oh, it's done.
What an interesting feeling, you know.
Yeah. Was it sort of a little...
Yeah, because kind of a letdown, yeah, as we were saying. I think, you know, the times and the experiences and the people that they sort of mean or the meaning that they sort of convey in my head or brain or whatever is a wonderful place to kind of revisit. And so now it's done and I'd like to keep revisiting it. So.
Indeed. Well, I wonder to you, Danielle, whether one should also think of collecting as an investment. And obviously if you're collecting erasers, you know, I don't know if that's worth anything, but is that another way to think of collecting?
Well, you know, an old-time dealer once told me, and I've heard it many, many times, when you buy anything, you better like it because you may have it for a very, very long time. You don't count on flipping an object unless you really know what you're doing. And I tell my readers to leave that to the professionals and the hedge fund managers who can absorb the losses and so on. But if you're a mom-and-pop type of collector, buy what you like, but buy the best that you can buy within that category. Collecting tends to fall into stratifications. At the very best will always sell first. The lowest ground has a market, but the middle never moves or moves very, very slowly. So when you buy the best you can afford, and you may have to hold on to it for a while.
Let me go back to you, Randy. We got a lot of people that want to join our conversation, but I am interested in, and you referenced this a little bit earlier about the difference between collecting and hoarding. But, you know, what is that, I guess if evolution is the right word, what is that process that happens when someone really just sort of gets in over their head and these objects that they've been collecting begin to take on a different kind of value?
Well, it's sort of interesting whether or not there is a continuum from collecting to hoarding. And I'm not sure there is because there are some very distinct differences we see between someone who suffers from hoarding disorder and someone who's, say, a heavy collector. And the first difference is in the way in which the items are collected. Most of the time in hoarding problems, it's a very impulsive kind of collecting or acquiring where there's very little specificity, that the person sees something they like and they can't resist getting it, even though they may in the end not have a use for it and already have a bunch like it, but they don't remember that they have them. So it's not like putting a piece in a collection. It's more like, I see this, I like it, I want it, and I collect it. So it's the planning process is not there. And the other way where it's very different is in what happens to the possession when it comes into the home. And for people with hoarding problems, a major symptom or a major component of hoarding is the inability to keep it all organized. So it all ends up in a cluttered pile in the middle of the room, rather than being organized into a collection that can be displayed. And a third way in which it's different is that in hoarding, people really experience a sense of shame about all of this. So they don't like anyone to see what their home is like. So it's very different than a collector who likes to put things on display and likes to talk about them with other people and so forth.
And I remember from interviewing you and actually from time to time having watched some of these hoarding shows on television, it often seems that there's trauma. I mean, there's some deep trauma somewhere and something about the acquisition and then the hoarding is a way of mitigating some of that trauma.
Yes, certainly.
Marty, may I?
Yeah, hold on, Danielle. Let me just give Randy a chance. Yep. Go ahead.
Certainly, sometimes that's true, that trauma is sort of something that is behind some of the hoarding problems. We see people with hoarding disorder report a much higher frequency of traumatic life events or stressful life events. Not universal. It's not everyone with hoarding disorder reports this, but a larger number than we would expect by chance. But interestingly enough, we don't see a very high prevalence of post-traumatic stress disorder. So you would think that people with a high frequency of traumatic experiences would have a higher level of PTSD, but we don't really see that. So it suggests that maybe these possessions provide some kind of a buffer for them that prevents them from the development of PTSD.
Oh, that's interesting. Danielle, go ahead.
I'm sorry, I interrupted
you. No, that's fine.
In writing an article that helped me understand what was going on, it's called Why We Collect, and it may codify things for your readers, your listeners, rather, and they can find it on the web. But I interviewed a person, an executive at Hazelden, and they said that collecting is an addiction only or particularly if the behavior continues despite harmful consequences. And I think that harmful consequences sort of puts it into play right there.
Indeed. Well, let me just quickly reintroduce everybody. That's Danielle Arnett. Also with us, Randy Frost and Ronald Bishop, when we are talking about collecting, and a lot of phone calls and a lot of comments as well. And that phone number again, 1-888-477-9499. Did you want to add anything before we get to our callers?
Just a couple of quick points. I think one of the intervening little spots that we haven't talked a little bit about is how we come to regard just the act of collecting. And I think it goes back to something that was said earlier, too, as sort of a form of the lottery. When we interviewed some, I took my wonderful wife down to Baltimore to a taping of the Antiques Roadshow, and one of the things that we found is that the folks who brought their items there thought that the appraiser on the show was going to commit to a high value estimate, and they were just going to be able to put their kids through college. And the emotional side that we've been talking about, the stories, the memories, just sort of weren't gone, but they were just sort of pushed aside while that value estimate was being made. And so I think sometimes in the media the tendency is to sort of overplay the fact that something might be valuable. And just very quickly, the other thing, I think we also in media content and other places tend to pathologize a lot of behaviors that maybe haven't quite gotten to the point that, you know, Randy has described earlier, that, you know, we call it an addiction when it isn't. And so that just sort of spikes the interest or the confusion or the tension and doesn't allow a reasoned discussion about the issue.
I mean, we're talking about people that have a passionate interest in something.
Sure.
I mean, how great is that, right?
Yeah.
To care about things and to be an expert and to go exploring.
Right.
Let me get Tina from Egg Harbor to join us. Hi, Tina. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi
there.
I have antique dealers in my family and wanted to comment on their role in facilitating positive experiences for collectors at both physical places like Brimfield Market in Massachusetts, as well as online markets such as eBay. They really enjoy talking to would-be customers, and sometimes customers are reluctant to have a conversation with dealers about the things that they would like to collect.
And why do you think that is?
If they feel it's part of a negotiation tactic, if it would be buyers, they're maybe nervous about, they don't know how to talk about those items, and maybe they feel, I don't know, intimidated sometimes.
Because maybe they don't feel quite as expert maybe as the antique dealer. Let me see what Danielle Arnett has to say. Tina, thanks for the call. Danielle, any comments?
On why people collect?
Well, I think it's really she was talking about antique dealers and the, I guess the role of facilitating collections.
I see that a lot, and I think that antique dealers right now are really feeling pressure from a paradigm that's changing in collecting. Your millennials and young people who are coming along are not that into objects, and so the way to get them hooked, quote unquote, is, I think, through the emotional aspect of collecting.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was listening to a lot of the conversation, and what I was having in my head was a neon sign going, Pinterest, 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 because to many new collectors, having is not the object. It is accumulating the visuals. But that's a whole other show, okay?
Well, actually, no. I think that's actually quite interesting that you don't – that sometimes when I'm looking at you, Ronald Bishop, sometimes just looking at something, I mean, not necessarily having it like your football helmet, sometimes
right.
just looking at it online can give someone the pleasure of collecting.
And they don't have to go out and try to buy it, right?
Right, right.
They don't have to dust it or pop it.
Exactly, exactly. I think – but I think it goes to a really excellent – that was an excellent observation. I think the act of displaying, there's a line in the literature that talks about how we've sort of come to see our homes as, and this may be going off topic a little, as sort of museums. We curate our lives rather than live them or, you know, interact with, I guess, the items. And so the act of displaying for maybe younger collectors, the millennials who are getting into it with the advice of the antiques dealers that
right.
Annette was talking about, maybe more into that because they have the access to the tools and the technology and maybe that, you know, older folks like me are not quite up to speed on. And that becomes the part of collecting that they
yeah.
put the most emphasis on.
Yeah.
And you don't have to dust things.
And so. You don't have to dust things either. Randy, anything you want to add to that?
Well, I think one of the things that the caller mentioned early on was the sort of positive aspects of collecting. And I think what we see now with the development of things like Pinterest and other TV shows like the show American Pickers shows this sort of dramatic kinds of enjoyment that people get out of finding old stuff and telling its story. That these old objects, these antique objects, almost have a story that needs to be told. And they get such a kick out of doing it at the same time where they're operating it as a business. But I think that's the kind of enjoyment in the physical world that collectors have.
Yeah. Did you want to add something? I'll get Anshan to join us.
Sure. No, I think it's an excellent point. I think with Pickers, I think the other aspect of the show that's fascinating that we hinted at earlier is the fact that most of the time these are people who have a lot of stuff that isn't maybe properly curated. Some are really right. well organized that they want to get rid of. They've hit the end of the quest. They've decided for various reasons.
I have 17 cars. Maybe I don't need
right.
another one.
You know, I want to save my marriage, not leave all these things for my children to have to deal with. And so they go through and invite the two guys, the main characters in the show, to come in and sift through, buy things, and just relieve them of some of the, not right. burden necessarily, but the stuff that they, you know, their kids might not want to have.
Let me get Anshant from Aston to join us. Anshant, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, Marty. The name's John.
Oh, John.
And my weakness is old license plates.
Uh-huh.
I've been over 55 years collecting them since I was at the age of four. But what I find is that the thrill of collecting something that was never intended to be collected and the thrill of the chase. And it's sometimes not what you have in your collection. Sometimes it's what you don't have that you're seeking. And the thrill of locating it, and specifically if you can locate an item that quote unquote, hasn't been collected before. If you can right. find one in an original family, perhaps at an auction, as opposed to buying it at an antique shop or specifically on eBay, I would gladly give everything that I found on eBay back if eBay would never have existed, because it kind of waters down that thrill.
Well, that's very interesting, John. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Randy, does that make sense to you? I mean, what he likes is that he's collecting something that he doesn't think a lot of other people are collecting, and I guess making it and maybe him special.
Yeah, I can certainly see that, and that it, if it becomes too easy, then there's no challenge.
Right.
And so if it's the challenge that is the joy in collecting, then you can see where if collecting is made so easy, then you need to move on to a new challenge, a new game almost.
And Danielle, we're almost having a break here, but does that sort of fit into how you see collectors, which is it's fun?
Absolutely.
It's fun to find the thing that no one else is looking for.
Absolutely. I've heard the pursuit call and the capture called better than sex. It's just
really?
An endless search. Yes.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. We are talking about collecting, apparently better than sex. Talking with Danielle Arnett. She writes the Smart Collector column for Tribune Content Agency. Also with us is Randy Frost. He's a professor of psychology at Smith College, happens to be a leading expert on hoarding. In fact, co-authored a book called Stuff, Compulsive Hoarding and the Meaning of Things. And we're also talking with Ronald Bishop, and again, professor of communications at Drexel University here in Philadelphia. He's written several books, including More, The Vanishing of Scale in an Over-the-Top Nation. And we still have lots of people that want to join our conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and send us a tweet at Marty Moss Cohen. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss Cohen, talking with Danielle Arnett, Ronald Bishop, and Randy Frost about collecting. And a couple of comments here. We have a tweet from Jay. He says, I don't collect stuff, but I do tend to collect people who collect stuff. Not exactly sure what to make of that comment, but interestingly, a Facebook comment from Elizabeth. I never collected Beanie Babies, but I remember a friend looking at me in horror when I tried to cut the TY label. I guess that's a real no-no. And it is interesting. Maybe I'll put this to you since you're sitting across from me, Ron, which is that there are certain items that are designed to be collected. And I don't know if that's – it's very different from collecting license plates, for
yes.
instance.
And I think that while there may be sort of a in the case of my niece and nephew when they were little, they collected Beanie Babies. But there was a personal start to it, but it was still a market – an item that was meant to be – collected rather than we talked before the show about how my brother, when we were little, my dad was a sales rep and we traveled a lot, and he would collect the little wrapped bars of hotel soap, and he ended up with like 500 or 600 of them. And that, not to make a judgment about what's genuine or not, but it certainly was less commodified.
Sure.
And so to go back to what the caller said, I think it meant maybe more, but in a different way too, than something, you know, I have to get the latest Beanie Baby and worry about someone cutting the tag off.
Yeah.
That, you know, is a clear no-no. But I think there is a difference.
Danielle, do you want to weigh in on that?
Yeah, I think serious collectors, whatever that is,
right.
make a distinction between collectibles and antiques. And they tend to frown on manufactured markets. And that was a classic bubble. The business with Hallmark ornaments and strawberry shortcake and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And, there are manufactured markets.
We have another Facebook. Oh, I'm sorry. No, go ahead. Okay, I'll go ahead. Another Facebook comment from Eliza. She says, I collect antique children's cups. A friend collects the signatures of famous composers, an expensive collection. I mean, talk about a hunt, right?
Really? That could get pricey.
That is. And I wanted to, Randy, and then we'll get back to our callers, about it's interesting how some things all of a sudden, and I'm not saying they're manufactured this way, but and perhaps it's the passage of time, something becomes, something to collect, whether it's, you know, lunchboxes from the 1960s or something. It's interesting how things can go in and out of favor.
Yes, yes. I remember when I was a child, comic books. And I had friends who collected comic books, and I thought, you know, at the time, my friends who collected them, you know, we read them and so forth. When I got to college, I walked into a friend's room and sat down, and there was a comic book in a sleeve, and I pulled it out and started reading it, and he came into the room and just blew up at me.
I bet he did.
This was a collectible, and you don't use a collectible. You collect it. You don't enjoy it as it is for its original purpose.
Let me get Beth from Bethlehem to join our conversation. Hi, Beth. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just have a comment, basically. Last year, this time, we moved across town, myself and my husband and my two millennials. And in the process of moving, you have to touch every single thing that you own and put it in a box and pay someone to take it across town. So at a certain point, we looked at each other in the wee hours of the morning and said, oh, my God, why do we have all this stuff? Hmm. And it brought about this big discussion as a family, you know, what are we going to take with us to this new house? And my kids eventually ditched so much stuff. We sold it. We gave it away. We donated it. And at one point, my teenage son looked at me and he goes, you know, Mom, I really think it's more important to collect experiences than to collect things. And it's just an interesting comment, I think, on the meaning that we as a culture attached to the things that we own. And since that move, we'll go shopping and I'll be out in the stores with my kids and they'll pick stuff up that they think is cute or nice or interesting and then they put it down. They don't really want a lot of stuff anymore. And they are focusing on doing things with their friends and doing things in their life that they can remember and take with them. Because in the end, I said, you know, if the house burns down, what is important? Hmm. What do we take with us?
Well, that's
we take each other.
Beth, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. Let me toss it first to you, Randy Frost.
Yeah, there is a little bit of research looking at the relationship between buying things and happiness. And one of the conclusions of the research is just exactly what the caller mentioned, and that is if you spend your money buying experiences, in the long run, you're happier with those experiences than you are buying things. Mm. And one of the reasons is that if you buy a thing, that thing has sort of a discrete life, and then it maybe goes somewhere, maybe ends up in your basement for years, unless you move and face the sort of situation the caller faced. But an experience is something that you rehearse, and then you talk with the people you experience that with. And that's the sort of thing that brings out the happiness in spending money on experiences rather than spending money on things.
Danielle, I'd be curious what you have to say. As you said, you kind of had to go through a period of shedding some things that you and your husband had collected.
Right. Well, let me switch for a minute to my readers with the column. 4 or 5 years ago, I got the last letter from a reader saying, how do I find something for a column? It has been a steady stream of how do I get rid of this thing I inherited? My grandmother left me this. What is it? How do I sell it? People are in a general shedding mood. And millennials particularly, as our listener said, are not into things. They're into experiences. And a bottom line in my column, I tell readers it's just stuff. And that may sound like heresy, but you can be a collector. But be aware that this is going to be with you for a while. And what are you going to do with it when you go on to the great flea market in the sky? You know?
Yeah,
you going to burden somebody else with it?
Well, I don't know the answer to that.
That's another thing.
Yes, indeed. Anything you want to add to that, Ron?
Well, fortunately, the football helmets are small.
I keep thinking about your football helmets having this conversation.
But as we were talking, though, especially with the caller, I remembered that for a while I was a fairly avid collector of baseball caps. And I have, as Randy mentioned, two big tubs of them in the basement, almost 200 of them. I had completely forgotten. And it goes to, you know, how experiences are fluid and change and you call up certain meanings at certain times. So maybe I should start searching for a charity that can use them for.
But do you feel that need to shed?
I mean, yeah. I think we've been talking a lot about it, come to think of it. My wife and I, and just trying to you know, live the experiences and relive or revisit and then just move on.
Beth, thanks for the call. Let me see what Denise from Clayton, New Jersey has to say. Denise, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. Yes.
Hi there.
Thank you for having me.
You're welcome.
One of the things that I have a tendency to collect a number of things. I have collected coins. I have collected CB radios, computers, et cetera, and I've gotten rid of most of those except for the coins. And as my partner and I are getting, you know, closer and closer to, you know, traveling about in our RV, we've started, you know, getting rid of things. Things that I liked, I've taken photographs of because I realized I don't really need them. But one of the things that she referenced just recently is what we're doing with our life right now, or in our lives right now, as we get rid of things, is we're collecting still, but we're collecting space.
Oh,
and that, you know, that is the reference that we are putting to whenever we get rid of something, we say, we've just collected more space.
Good for you. It's kind of a way of reframing this whole thing. Denise, thanks for the call to Radio Times. Randy, I want to shift gears just for a second and then go back to you about hoarding and even how you suggest if someone knows someone who looks like they are a hoarder and maybe has concerns about them being sort of overwhelmed by all this stuff in their life, how do you suggest people approach them or begin to talk to them about it?
This is a very difficult issue, and one that has plagued many family members with people with hoarding problems. And one of the things that I advise people is the first thing that you can do, and perhaps the best thing you could do, is to visit the person's home. Now, often what happens is that when these visits happen, the family member or friend will start commenting about the clutter, and that sort of drives them away. So the person sometimes won't let them back in the home. But one of the things we find is that if someone is going into someone's home, someone with a hoarding problem, they will spend time trying to straighten up to make it livable, and they will begin to see that this is a problem. And if no one visits the home, those thoughts really aren't there. They don't really challenge the way in which they live. But when someone comes into their home, it's like they start to see their home through someone else's eyes. And this is one of the problems people with hoarding sort of lose focus. We call it clutter blindness. They get blinded to the fact that they can no longer use their kitchen, they can no longer use their bathroom, and so forth. They kind of learn to live without those things, even though it may be difficult. But when someone else comes into the home, it's as though they see the world from someone else's perspective, and it changes a little bit. So that's the first thing we always recommend to people.
Let me see what looks like Marilyn from Philadelphia has to say. Marilyn, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I have a friend who's married to a man who is an extreme hoarder. It got so bad he had to move out of their bedroom, and he has his own hoarding room that he sleeps in, but you can't see the floor, you can't see the top of the dresser. He has just enough space on the bed that he can sleep in, and he's got things from the 1960s, such as a pair of bell-bottom jeans. Now, he never uses this stuff, he never looks at it, and when my girlfriend says, I'm going to get rid of this stuff, he gets wild, crazy, and threatens her and says, if you touch anything, I'm going to do thus and such to you. And I'm just trying to figure out, what is this all about? Mm. Is it a comfort level? Is it a fear level? Why does someone go to that extreme that he has to be in a separate room with all this stuff?
Well, Marilyn, we have done whole shows about it. In fact, I did a show with Randy Frost and his co-author. But Randy, let me just go back to you if you have any suggestions for Marilyn.
Well, the description that Marilyn provides is pretty classic in terms of what we see in hoarding problems, that there is not only this sense of ownership in these things, but a sense of control that is tight, so that any suggestion by someone else that they're going to do something with his stuff, even if it's not throwing it away, just moving it, is the reaction is really pretty extreme and pretty emotional. Now, what we do see often in these cases is that a relationship can exist if the rules are drawn up so that the person with the hoarding problem limits their hoarding to a certain area of the home. Mm. But if those rules get violated and the stuff then populates the whole living space, then the relationship tends to fracture. And that's when we see, and what happens with people with hoarding problems is they're less likely to get married, they're less likely to remain married, and they're more likely to live alone. And once they are alone, their hoarding behavior gets worse.
Yeah.
Is there a cure for this? I mean, he has his own hoarding room that he lives in. Is there a cure for this?
There is a treatment for it, and we're doing. There are now, a couple of dozen research centers around the world that are trying to test out how best to treat this. We do have a cognitive behavioral treatment for this. The best resource is to go to the International OCD Foundation website. Huh? There's a hoarding center there, and they will have a list of therapists who may be nearby, who specialize in treating hoarding.
Marilyn, I appreciate the call
Thank
to Radio
you.
Time. Sure. Thanks for calling in. Ron, we're in the holiday season, the gift-giving season. I'm back to your football helmets here. Did people buy them for you, or was this something that you really wanted for yourself?
No, actually. It was sort of my thing. Certainly my wife was very supportive and would, you know, we were talking earlier about sort of marking the change of the season by when the machines would be in the stores for the mm-hmm. first time, and she'd notice that and tell me, which was lovely.
Yeah.
But, you know, it was sort of just a solo, happy pursuit.
And Danielle, do you miss your collections at all?
Not at all. Like your caller, I revel in the space. I really do. And going back when you asked me when I knew I had crossed a line, you know, I was cleaning some silver, and I thought, why am I cleaning this again? It's not, I don't use it. I mean, it was a Victorian calling card tray, for goodness sakes. How many times have I had use for that? And it just, I heard a little voice that said, enough is enough. And honestly, I can tell you it was like a click. And I just made up my mind at that point, I've got to pare down. So it happens to different people in different ways.
How about for you, Randy? You enjoying your Swedish trolls there? Are they...
I do enjoy them, although I don't actively go out and collect them. My family will give them to me for presents and things, and I enjoy those. And I have several trolls sitting up in places in my laboratory, sort of overseeing the lab, protecting the data, and so forth.
Of course, collecting the data. Well, thanks to all three of you for joining us today in Radio Times. Randy Frost, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
You're welcome. He's the Harold and Elsa Cipolla Israel Professor of Psychology at Smith College, a leading expert on hoarding. In fact, co-authored a book called Stuff, Compulsive Hoarding and the Meaning of Things. Ronald Bishop, thank you very much as well.
Oh, you're welcome. It's a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. Professor of Communications at Drexel University, author of a number of books, including More, The Vanishing of Scale in an Over-the-Top Nation. And Danielle Arnett, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
It's been a pleasure.
A pleasure for us as well. She writes the Smart Collector column for Tribune Content Agency. Go to whyy.org/radiotimes, and you can find out much more about this program, including how to download podcasts of the show, how to find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, the show produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Bilder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens, and our intern this fall, Quinn Libson. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us.